Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Thank you very much indeed, as always, for being here. It's been a good week for the Arsenal, of course, starting with a 6-0 win over Sheffield United on Monday night. The Arsenal women are through to the Conti Cup final, having beaten Aston Villa in midweek as well. And we go into this weekend looking for 3 points against Brentford to go back to the top of the league for the first time since, is it Christmas Day? It could well be. And to put a little bit of pressure on our title rivals, Liverpool and Manchester City, playing this Sunday. So there's a lot going on. Not to mention the fact that, we've got the Champions League coming up as well on Tuesday. Some of the games this week, Real Madrid are through, Manchester City are through, Bayern Munich are through, PSG are through. And that is company that we want to keep when we play Porto at home next week. Will it be Barcelona or Napoli who go through from the other game? That's 1-1 on aggregate. And then the following evening, there's Atletico Madrid versus Inter. It's a 1-0 to Inter on aggregate in that game. And it's Borussia Dortmund to PSV Eindhoven 1-1. So all of these Champions League ties coming up next week, extremely finely poised. A lot could happen. And whatever about the rest of them, we obviously hope Arsenal are on the right side of things against Porto on Tuesday. Anyway, more on that game to come over the coming days. We'll preview it for you over on Patreon. No doubt myself and James will have a word or two about it when we chat on Monday in the Arscast Extra. But for now, let's just get on with the show. And with me to chew the Arsenal fat this week, I'm delighted to welcome back from Football London, it is Kaya Kainak. Hi there.
Hi, Andrew. How are you?
I'm just me today anyway, and I'm fine. How are you?
We're all very good, all of us, every last one.
Yeah, the split personalities of football fans and football reporters or correspondents, or however you want to put it. Let's talk a little bit about recent form, and it was another question put to Mikel Arteta today about Dubai. What was the magic in Dubai? And you know, there's no hidden answer here. I think you know. What have you observed, or have you observed anything different since that break than maybe, you know, in the first part of the season? Or, you know, is it a case that this is a team who maybe just needed to press the reset button for, to go forward in the season after a couple of bad weeks? It had been fine. Couple of bad games, didn't go well, press the reset button, and they've come back and basically started playing in a way that I think, you know, at the heart of it, people thought they were capable of, because in that first half of the season, there was always a sense that it's not quite there, it's not quite right, it's not quite what we thought or what it should be, and maybe this is what people were expecting from this season.
Yeah, I mean, it's the new PED, isn't it? Instead of performance-enhancing drugs, it's performance-enhancing Dubai. It's been really, really massive turnaround for Arsenal. And to be honest, that question gets put to Mikel nearly every single press conference and before and after games. Oh my God, what happened in Dubai? What did you do? What was your secret trick? I think just getting Arsenal out of the funk was the trick. I don't even think you can call it a trick. I don't think they were playing that badly before they went away on the international break. I thought when they lost to Liverpool in the FA Cup, it was, you know, obviously people say when you lose a game that the result was terrible, but they didn't play badly. They played really well against the most informed team in Europe. They probably should have been 2 or 3 nil up. The only issue was they didn't believe that they could put the chances away, and it's similar-ish at West Ham. I think the main thing is Arsenal now look like they believe that they're a team that can score. I also think that maybe perversely what's improved is defensively they're conceding less stupid goals. There's less sort of errors.
Mm.
You talk about the really impressive stats about the XG allowed and all that stuff, and that's really increased in terms of Arsenal being able to dominate teams, and teams don't feel like they have a hope against Arsenal. And it's weird because football's such an odd game in the sense that tactics and all that stuff play a massive, massive part, but so much of it is just vibes. And Arsenal have been a team, like I say, who look like they think they can score goals. Whereas before, every time a player went in on goal in that sort of run where they couldn't score, and Fulham aside, because Fulham was a terrible performance, but aside from that, they didn't look like a team who believed they were going to score lots of goals. Now they go into games looking like a team who think 4 goals is par for the course. It's a massive change. And I think, yeah, Rice was speaking about it in the mix zone on Monday, just how they never sort of questioned the caliber of player they had in the squad. I think it was just players believing in themselves and their ability to put chances away. And it might sound simplistic, but they found the confidence in front of goal, and momentum is a very difficult thing to stop. So I think it's a really good thing for Arsenal.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only game that Arsenal really played badly was Fulham. You know, you can make the argument that if you have 30 shots against West Ham and you don't score, that's also playing badly. But it's just sort of executing the final part badly rather than the overall performance. I think the overall performance against Fulham was really bad. Pretty much everybody had an off day. But we exist in a time where, in order to win the Premier League, you have to be close to perfect. Do you think in some ways that, you know, that weight of pressure, knowing that Man City are there and they've done what they've done, and knowing that Liverpool, despite maybe not being quite at the level that we've seen from some other Liverpool teams, have been there and done that and risen to that challenge and pushed Man City all the way on one occasion and just so close on a couple of others. And, you know, in the wake of those 2 defeats to West Ham and Fulham, there was a gap, then there was an FA Cup game, then there was another big gap, and it sort of gave everybody the chance to get very introspective about what was wrong and how poor things were and what Arsenal needed, when in reality it was a very, very small blip in the course of a season. I'm not saying that couldn't be crucial at the end of May. It might well be the difference. Who knows? But in that time period that maybe, you know, our poring over everything as fans wasn't quite the same way it was viewed internally, if you like, where, as you say, there was faith in their ability to get the job done and do what needed to be done, even if for a couple of weeks they made a very hard go of it.
Yeah, I think when Arsenal analyse games internally, like you say, it's nowhere near as results driven as the external analysis, because it doesn't have to be. Arsenal don't have to put their analysis of games into the wider context of the league in the way that most analysis of it is done. They just have to focus on improving themselves. Mm. And I think that makes a big difference, because it means that they're not so worried about, oh my God, we're losing games, we're playing terribly. They are worried about playing terribly. They're not worried about losing games, is what I meant to say there. And that's the most important thing when you look back on a game and you look back on it fairly and you think, is there an awful lot else we could have done? Arteta and his coaching staff, particularly in that West Ham game where you mentioned it, I don't know that there was anything more they could have done. And I don't know if there was anything more they could have done against Liverpool. I think that December month, people forget this because, you know, it's only 3 months ago, but it was relentless. I think there was it 7 games they played in December, and just covering the club, being at every single game, I personally found it exhausting. So God knows what it was like playing in every single game. And, you know, some players played every single minute throughout that month, and it makes a huge, huge difference. And now the gaps between the games have been bigger, and it is interesting going into after this March international break. Arsenal will probably be more or less 3 games every week, assuming they get past the test of Porto in the Champions League. So that's going to be a different thing for them to face. But they did struggle a bit with it, and the squad was stretched, and they were really, really tired and exhausted and all that stuff. And mentally, they looked quite fatigued as well. And I think people maybe underestimate the importance of mental fatigue when it comes to being able to just switch off from football and the pressures and being able to get away from it all when they went to Dubai. I think that was a huge thing. And now when they start games, I know they started games intensely before, but they start games and they're able to sustain that momentum. So what was so impressive about Sheffield United or West Ham or or Burnley or Newcastle was, yes, they started really impressively, and the difference being that they got the goal early, but then they were able to go on and better that and get more goals and rack up the kind of goal difference that their earlier season play did probably deserve. They just didn't seem to have enough in the tank to actually convert that into what they were creating. So I think that's been a huge, huge difference for them. And I think, yeah, Arsenal look a lot better for being a lot more well-rested.
Yeah. How much, you know, can Arsenal learn or take from a game like the one against Sheffield United, where they're expected to win and they're expected to dominate, they're expected to score goals? But, you know, things like that are sort of easier said than done. And you know, the fact that we couldn't really score goals before Christmas, or in that little Christmas period, rather. And I think there were 8 games in December. I just had a look. So, you know, the schedule was pretty hectic. But, you know, to have come back and to sort of be goal crazy, if you like, 5 against Palace, 6 against West Ham, 6 against Sheffield United, 5 against Burnley, 4 against Newcastle, that in some ways maybe they're trying to make up for that little blip where goals and goal difference and you know what that might mean at the end of the season could be really, really important in a tight Premier League. It could be goal difference. It could come down to sheer goal difference. But, you know, from an analytical point of view, or what they will take away from a game like Sheffield United, I mean, is it a case of just, okay, we have taken the maximum from this game? You know, we can expect to win, we can expect to score a few goals, but we've done 6, and, you know, this is kind of what you need to do if you are going to build the momentum that you need to go on and continue to challenge for a title, especially with some of the fixtures that Arsenal have left.
Yeah, I don't think they'll have learned too much tactically from the game. No. We didn't see anything different from Arsenal. They played exactly the way they've been playing throughout the past few weeks. They bullied Sheffield United. They stood up to them physically when they tried to roughhouse them. Like, that Bogle tackle on Odegaard didn't affect them, whereas in seasons gone by, it might have done. You know, Ben White was inverting, but also attacking really well. Kivior played as a natural left back. You know, all the things we've been talking about over the past few weeks, they were all present and on display. And I guess what they will have learned is like you say, when you're up against massive, gigantic obstacles in the form of Liverpool and Manchester City, you need to be relentless, but you don't just need to be relentless. You need to be relentlessly excellent. Mm. And Arsenal, I think, yes, they've had winning runs, and yes, they've been able to put together impressive streaks under Mikel Arteta, but it's never been like this. It's never been where they properly dominated games week after week. Porto aside, every game in 2024, they've absolutely dominated, and the opposition team hasn't had a single sniff. That is what you're dealing with right now, and that is the standards you need to keep and set up if you're going to beat Manchester City and Liverpool to a league title. And for Arsenal, their biggest hurdle, I guess, and you can view it in two ways. You can view it as an advantage in the sense that they're hungry because they haven't won, whereas the other teams have. But you can also view it as they have the point to prove, and that might make them nervous. The more they keep doing this, and the more they keep proving, hey, we can keep up with these guys. We are as good as they are. We can set the standards they set. The more they keep doing that, and just listen, Sheffield United, it's not going to define their season just as Burnley or West Ham were, but the little things along the way will make a huge, huge difference. And I think that's standing Arsenal, in good stead as they go into some really difficult games after the international break.
Yeah, the dominance was amazing against Sheffield United. You know, even taking into account how poor they were, and they were and are a poor side and are probably going to get relegated. In fact, I would say definitely going to get relegated. apologies if we have any Sheffield United listeners, but I think that is what's going to happen. And, you know, I had a look at the heat map. So I was looking at Gabriel's heat map and William Saliba's heat map, and they were the heat maps of midfielders, basically. Yeah. You know, Saliba was over the right-hand side. You're looking, that's a pretty classic right-sided midfield player in a nice 4-4-2, and Gabriel was higher up and on the left-hand side, obviously.
I think Saliba had more passes on his own than Sheffield United did combined in the game.
It's crazy. Like, I know a lot of that is just because of the way we control things and play the ball around, but also, you know, it wasn't a case that it was sort of Gabriel and Saliba passing the ball back and forward to each other outside the Arsenal D. It was where they were making those passes and just how involved those guys are and how crucial they are to the way that Arsenal dominate. And I was thinking about you know, things Mikel Arteta said in the past about the way he wants his team to play and things that everyone went, ooh, that's good. But then we went through periods where that didn't happen or it was difficult to produce what he wanted. Here's a quote. I want to become more dominant. I want to press even higher than we do. You could see on Thursday night how aggressive the team is. I want to have 55 shots on target. I want to concede zero goals every game. This is the aim of where we want to get to and where we're going to evolve. If I were to ask you to put a date on that quote, give it a guess.
Oh, it's interesting. I was hoping you'd tell me so I wouldn't have to sound like a fool. It's not Watford a few seasons ago. That was the 50,000 passes. I want to say 2020.
It was October 2020.
Okay, thank you for accepting my ploy to get out of your year. Over 12 months.
I didn't want to ask you for the month and the day. You know, I didn't want to get that specific. It was actually ahead of a game against Sheffield United, which I should look up whether we won or not, because that might tell us something about the trajectory of this team as well. But
funnily enough, the last game before I joined Football London. So yeah,
was it
a time ago? Yeah.
Okay, and we got beaten. No, we didn't. That
was 2-1, I think.
Sorry, I'm looking at the wrong season here. When they actually beat us. Yes. Arsenal 2-1, Sheffield United. You're right. Bukayo Saka, Nicolas Pepe with the goals. Aaron Ramsdale in goal for Sheffield United that day. We'll talk about Aaron in a minute. But it is, you know, it is remarkable how, you know, what he said he wanted to do and what Arsenal are doing now, has come to fruition. That, you know, managers often say things and managers will give you a soundbite maybe and not too much insight into how they want to play. Because, you know, very often if you're brutally honest with that and you don't deliver, you know, you end up looking like an idiot. But I think he was always confident in his ability to fashion a team who could eventually play that way. I think, was he playing like a back three, something like that, around that time? It could have been maybe when Kieran Tierney was playing as maybe a left-sided centre-half. I'm not 100% sure. But, you know, it's certainly a lot different back then than it is right now, and the caliber of player and the technicality of the players. But it just demonstrates what a job it is to put something like this together and how long realistically it can take for a team to sort of get to where a manager wants them to be. And I wonder, maybe are there perhaps some parallels with Jurgen Klopp in a way, in terms of how he built Liverpool sides, who were good but always maybe missing a player or two, or it took them a while to develop into like full Klopp, if you like, and he brought in Virgil van Dijk and Alisson. You know, you could maybe again draw a through line between someone like Virgil van Dijk and Declan Rice as that kind of a figure within a team. So, you know, that's allowing Arteta to go full Arteta, if you like.
Yeah, it shows how creative journalists are that he was asked a very similar question today in the press conference as we're recording this. And his response was something along the lines of, it was difficult to envision what I wanted without knowing what players I was going to have. But interestingly, throughout this transfer process of recruitment and overhauling the squad, and I'm sure the squad more or less from that Sheffield United game, I'd imagine the only players surviving would probably be someone like a Bukayo Saka, maybe Reece Nelson was involved.
Gabriel,
not too many beyond that, I wouldn't think.
No, Mohamed Elneny is there.
Of course.
He started that game in midfield, but pretty much everybody else has gone. Eddie Nketiah was there also. He started that game too.
But the overhaul, I guess, there shows how clearly Arteta came in and thought, this isn't for me. I'm going to try and make the best of a bad situation, because I think in his ideal world, Mikel Arteta would never come in and played a back three, which is what won Arsenal the FA Cup. He didn't want to play that kind of football. And we look back on it now, and the way Arsenal won that FA Cup, they defended for their lives against Man City, and they, you know, they beat a poor Chelsea team, but they did defend for a lot of the a lot of the game. You'd never expect Arsenal to play that way now. And he had in mind a way of playing, and he then went out to find the right players to do that. And once he got the right players, he felt he could do it. And it's been interesting how slowly the integration has been, like you say. And I think what Arsenal probably learned from that Klopp example is getting the right player, not just getting a player for the sake of it. And I think back to that January window in a COVID season, one of the COVID seasons, where it was Arsenal have to sign a striker. They haven't got a striker. Why aren't they signing a striker? And they didn't sign anyone, and it was a catastrophe. And then they waited and they got Gabriel Jesus, who I think we'd all agree is a perfect Mikel Arteta player, a few months later. And there's been so many situations like that where they could have just got a body and they haven't done, and they've learned from seasons gone by. And I think that's a real example from Liverpool. And then having the right players to play the way Mikel Arteta wants to play. And he quite clearly has a philosophy that he believes in. And I think he said in the past in press conferences that you can't convince everyone else of what you're trying to do if you don't believe it yourself. He said maybe you can do it for a game or two, but unless you fundamentally believe in what you're trying to do and what you're trying to get across to your players, it's never going to work. And he has always believed, even in the times when he was losing every week and Arsenal were in the relegation zone and it was really, really bad, Mikel Arteta's faith in his own abilities has never really been in question. And his way that he's wanted to play has never really been in question. So that's been a massive change, a massive learning curve for Arsenal. And it's credit to those above him that they stuck with him. And it's now reaping the benefits.
Yeah. You mentioned Gabriel Jesus there. I think it's really fascinating that Arsenal in this period, where perhaps they're playing, could you say it's the best football we've played under Mikel Arteta in this last seven games? I know it's a very short spell of games. And clearly, we played some brilliant football last season too.
Yeah.
But is this perhaps the most Arteta-ish football, if that's the right word, if you know what I mean, where there is this combination of dominance, control, ruthlessness, efficiency, you know, defensively and offensively, you know, that it seems to be basically the blueprint of what he has always wanted to produce at Arsenal. And I think it's so interesting that we've done it without players who last season were absolutely fundamental to a step forward that Arsenal took last season. You know, Gabriel Jesus came in and everyone went, oh my God, we have a number nine who can actually move. This is brilliant. And Oleksandr Zinchenko, another player who came in and did things on the pitch and in areas of the pitch that we'd never seen before. We were playing our left back internally. He was popping up here, there, everywhere. You know, he scored some goals. He made some assists. He was just so fundamental to what was good about Arsenal for most of last season. Hasn't been part of this. Thomas Partey, of course, made his comeback against Sheffield United the other night. Get the WD-40 out because that man looks rusty. but, you know, there is something to the way that teams evolve, and sometimes it's deliberate, and sometimes a team evolves in front of your eyes in a way that you didn't necessarily think was possible. I will say that there is a tendency in football analysis, generally speaking, for things to be a bit short term. So a guy who's out of the team when the team is playing well instantly becomes disposable. We don't need this guy anymore, which I think is nonsense when it comes to players like Jesus and even Zinchenko, who I know divides opinion, but I think still has a role to play in this team this season for sure. But when Mikel Arteta looks at what his team is producing and how they're producing it, I wonder if not quite he stumbled across something, but like, necessity is the mother of invention and all that kind of stuff, where he has had to deal without these players and he has had to play Liverpool, you know, without big players and play Newcastle without big players. And people will say, well, Sheffield United, Burnley, yeah, West Ham, you know, West Ham aren't getting beaten 6-0 every week. Newcastle aren't getting beaten 4-1 every week, whatever about Burnley and Sheffield United, you know, that they are. But he's had to do things without these big players who he would like to have had at his disposal. So I wonder when they think about, you know, going forward, what they're going to do this summer, even to the extent of how they're going to set the team up between now and the end of the season for certain games, if, you know, he will read something into the fact that those players, or that the team was capable of doing what they've done without them, which, again, does not mean that these guys can't and won't contribute between now and the end of the campaign.
Yeah, I think what Mikel has done is he's played the hand he's been dealt really, really well. So, yeah, all those players have been out. He's had a few little tweaks he's been able to make. So the big one that we all think of is Jorginho coming into the midfield and moving Havertz up front. That makes a huge, huge difference. So when Trossard plays and Havertz is in midfield and Rice is there, maybe Arsenal don't have the same dominance over possession. I mean, they're still very dominant, but it's not the same control over possession as when Jorginho plays. But then when Jorginho comes in against a team like Liverpool or a team like Newcastle or even Sheffield United, then Arsenal are completely dominant of the ball. So he's been able to do little tweaks here and there whenever he's been able to, and he's done them, in my opinion, really, really well. So I don't know if that's... I think, to be honest, what he'll take away from that is, God, think what I can do when I've got even more options at my disposal.
Yeah.
His thing has always been, I don't want a starting 11, I want a squad of 25. His thing has always been, I want to be as unpredictable as possible. So we asked him earlier in the year about losing Jurrien Timber. And we all know why losing Jurrien Timber was a bad thing. He looked really good in pre-season. He's a very good defender. He can invert. He can do all the things that the Mikel Arteta wants from a fullback. But Mikel Arteta's first thing, before he mentioned anything tactical or, you know, soft factor like leadership or anything, was we wanted to be less predictable for our opponents, and we haven't been able to do that. Same with Thomas Partey. That's something he's wanted throughout from his squad. And he's finally, you know, with the players coming back, he's finally getting closer to that. And I think during this run of games, as much as Arsenal, you mentioned that, you know, they've kind of stumbled across, but they've fallen into a lineup which really works, and there's not been too many changes. He's tweaked it a bit, and I think he'd love to tweak it more. And think about Mikel Arteta's galaxy brain. Like, think about what he would want to do. His ability to sort of keep that on a leash is impressive. But imagine if he's allowed to roam wild with his galaxy brain, and he's got so many players that he can do whatever he wants. That's what he wants. And I think he constantly thinks there's places where we can do better. There's positions where we can do better. And he was even asked about the forward position today, and he didn't talk about Ivan Toney specifically, but he did talk about how they've made their plans for how they want to improve the squad. They made them at the start of the season. So they made them at the end of the last summer transfer window. So they've known for a long time where they want to improve and what they want to improve. So I think maybe the big learning point from this run is, God, think what I can do if I've got even more options available to me. And as much as things have worked out really well with the 11 that he's been able to play, and players like Kibior, for example, getting a bit of rhythm, having looked really rusty when he was coming in and out of the side and things like that, that's obviously been maybe a fortunate thing. Although even that, Arteta's tweaked it a bit to have White coming in inverting and Kibior playing a more natural left back. So there have been things that he's done, and I think he'll be thinking, God, think what I could do if there's even more things that I'd be able to do.
Yeah, I mean, there is a school of thought, isn't there, that he'll find something that works and sticks, you know, to it, maybe a little rigidly at times. You know, the way we looked at the squad this season, we thought there were more options to him. And I think part of, you know, what you just said about being unpredictable was, you know, had to be put on ice because of some of the injuries to some of the players. You know, these guys, Jesus, I think, you know, still a fantastic player. Zinchenko certainly gives us something different in specific games, I think, at left back. Tomiyasu hopefully coming back. Arteta was talking positively about him after the game on Monday night against Sheffield United. Timber hopefully back soon, probably, you know, targeting Man City game, you know, to make his return. But, you know, there are casualties of that as well. And was it you who asked the question today about Eddie, Reese,
yeah,
Smith Rowe? I thought that was you. Yeah, asking about that, where, you know, you could see the logic in the substitutions that he made on Monday about bringing players on to give them minutes. Jesus needed minutes. Partey needed minutes.
Cedric needed minutes.
Well, you know, there's you know, one of the things I think that they've, you know, maybe written down, but I think Timber as an alternate for Ben White, you know, means that you do have the option to change things around. And look, all jokes aside, you do need to protect Ben White a little bit because he's basically the only right back we've got. But, you know, there are casualties as well, aren't there? That you know, if we talk about evolution, if we talk about the squad going in a certain way, you know, there are players who kind of get a little bit left behind in that. You know, maybe Kieran Tierney last year was one of those that over the course of the season, it became apparent that his suitability for the football that Mikel Arteta wanted to play was not, you know, where it needed to be. And he's gone on loan, and we'll see what happens in the summer, but probably, you know, he'll end up being sold. It does look, as the season has gone on, let's say for someone like Eddie, as Trossard and Kai Havertz in particular has sort of grown into a role further forward, that, you know, the manager's selection decisions tell you a lot about, you know, your future and probably what you need to do.
Yeah, there's so many players who throughout this Arteta journey have been left behind. I mean, you think back to, I mentioned the FA Cup winning team. Pierre Aubameyang was the star of that. Arteta had no issues with casting him aside. We'll come on to a bit more depth later, but Aaron Ramsdale's another example where he was a nailed-on starter. He was, you know, one of the guys who was going to be in the team for years to come. They gave him a contract extension. Well, David Raya comes along. He's what I want more. See you later, Aaron. Thanks you for your time. Obviously not that clear cut, but...
Sure.
So I don't know if it's as cut and dry when it comes to the Hale End trio that were left on the bench. And I think individually they all have their own circumstances. But with Eddie specifically, I do think it's coming to a point now where it's funny because he seems to have this sort of, around this period of every season, he seems to go through a run of games where he doesn't barely feature at all. And then towards the end of the season, he seems to come back into contention and play quite an important role.
It's usually because of an injury or something. So fingers crossed, no disrespect to Eddie, but like, you know.
No, I agree. But on that point, the injuries happened and Eddie's still not getting the minutes. Jesus has been out for quite some time now and Eddie's still not getting the minutes. And that is the difference from years gone by where I think, like you say, Havertz has moved ahead of him in the pecking order. Trossard's moved ahead of him in the pecking order. Jesus is obviously ahead of him in the pecking order. Mm. And if he can't even get off the bench when the team is 6-0 up against Sheffield United, and you like you say, there were lots of circumstances, Jesus needed minutes and Vieira needed minutes and whatever. But if he can't do that, then he's surely thinking, I've had a really good go of it at Arsenal. You know, I've scored really important goals. I've contributed to a team that is potentially going to win the Premier League this season. But do I want to end my career as a guy who was involved in a title-winning squad, or do I want to go somewhere and score lots of goals in the Premier League and play regularly and maybe even become an England international? Because he's shown that when he's, you know, when he gets a regular scoring run in the team, that he makes England squads. And, you know, I think he backs himself to make that England squad. So those considerations will all be in his head. With Reece Nelson, I think maybe he seems like someone who's a little bit more okay with the role he's got, given that he did accept the contract, knowing exactly what was on the table and what exactly was going to be on offer. And Smith Rowe is, I know you're a huge fan and I'm a huge fan as well. And he was, I think for me, of the three who didn't come on Monday night, the most sort of the most disappointing in the sense that he's not scored for a while, has one cleared off the line against Newcastle, getting a bit of momentum going. I just felt you had to bring him on there. I know that there was all the Partey had to play, Jesus had to play, Vieira had to play. You had to protect Ben White, and I can't remember what the other sub was.
It was Trossard. Yeah, you know, did it need to
be
Trossard?
Fresh and involved. And listen, you can explain it. You can provide very understandable reasons. And that's why when I phrased the question, I didn't want to sort of phrase it as a, why the hell didn't you bring Emile Smith-Rowe on kind of thing. But it is... He deserves, in my opinion, more opportunities because he's done it in the past in the way that maybe some of the others haven't. But again, he'll have 2 years left in his contract in the summer. And you talk about players being left behind as the team evolves. And I really hope that's not the case for him. But yeah, with each passing week that he doesn't get a start or he doesn't sort of play maybe games he should, you wonder. But who knows? Maybe he'll start against Brentford. There's Porto coming up and there's big games and all that kind of stuff. And maybe that'll be a chance, but we live in hope when it comes to him.
We do have a few questions from our Discord members, which we'll do now in a second. But the other thing I just wanted to ask you about with regards to Mikel Arteta was, you know, you do all the press conferences, you do the post-game, the pre-game press conferences. You know, he's a guy who, generally speaking, doesn't give a great deal away, particularly when it comes to injury news. You know, he can talk well and say things, But I'm curious as to what you think, how much of this is like his own personality? I think some of it obviously is, but how much of it is about not being someone who gives any ammunition to anybody else? That as part of a very deliberate strategy, he will answer questions in a way which will never come back to sort of bite him in the arse. Like, he's never going to get involved in a Mourinho-esque tete-a-tete with another manager. That's not going to happen. You know, before Sheffield United, he was really respectful and said Sheffield United's a really, really difficult place to go, even though everybody knows this season it's not. He talked about the Brentford game. Well, you know, Brentford, it was very difficult when we went there. They always make us suffer. They're going to make us suffer again. This is what I expect from this time around. You know, nothing to sort of wind them up. No little thing to pin up on the fucking dressing room or the dressing room wall as like a motivational thing. You know, even when it came to the Liverpool Man City game, and he was asked, like, you know, what do you think? Who do you think's going to win? Who do you prefer to win? He said, it's nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got fucking loads to do with you. I know you're not in control of it, but it has, you know, very, very strong connection to you and what you want to do with yourself this season. So, you know, as a reporter and as somebody who has to file copy and write stories, you know, how do you find that aspect of what he does and how he answers these questions? Like, you know, you can understand it, but... you know, come on, just give us a little bit.
Listen, I find it, as every Arsenal journalist who you have on this podcast and anyone you talk to, I find it frustrating. But that's because, from a selfish perspective, I want him to give me a story that I can write and that I can publish on the Football London website. And my sort of colleagues will say, you know, we want to publish, we need paper inches to fill and column inches and all that stuff. So that's the perspective that journalists will come at it from. Obviously, there are interesting questions and there are questions that need to be asked, and we try to ask them as well. But a lot of the time you're trying to get a story. And to be honest, sometimes it's not even to get a news headline. It's just so you can sort of plan a bit far ahead, particularly when it comes to team news. But at the same time, as much as I find it frustrating, I never get too upset about it because I totally understand it.
Mm.
And I think about what I would do if I was in that position. I think every person listening to this podcast would be thankful that I'm not in that position. But I don't think I'd want to give any momentum or anything to anyone else that might fuel them. And whenever you speak to anyone and you're trying to get injury stories and you call contacts around the club and you call people who you're trying to, you know, get, who might be helpful for you, the thing they're always saying uniformly from people who have worked there for years to newer employees to whoever, it's Mikel is so, so obsessed with not giving anyone else even an inch when it comes to an advantage, that he will not do anything. He will ensure that nothing is given away. He keeps a very close circle when it comes to the team news. We all remember when that press conference, I think during the COVID season, where he talked about he knew where the leak had come from and he plugged it.
The mole.
Exactly.
That's what it was, yeah.
And he knows what he's doing and he's very on it when it comes to that stuff. And it's interesting because I obviously wasn't covering the club when Arteta was a player, but I speak to more experienced journalists who were, and they say he was an open book and that he was really talkative and that he would, you know, give really detailed answers and he'd be happy to give his opinions on things. But now he's a lot more reserved, and it's a shame because sometimes it's interesting. So Arsene Wenger, I think from a media perspective, everyone was spoiled because he would talk about literally anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when it comes to things like that, so the wider rules of the game, for example, the blue card story a few weeks ago, which was a bit of a non-starter as a story, but it would have been interesting to hear, you know, what Arteta genuinely thought about that, just because he's a guy who is high up in the game, influential figure, clearly an intelligent man when it comes to footballing stuff as well. So, you know, it would have been interesting to hear. And on those things, I think he can let his guard down a little bit more. But I do understand when it comes to the team news, and as much as it can be like getting blood from a stone, and you have to work really hard, and he'll try his best to sort of wiggle around it, and you have to ask questions in a specific way, and I think it probably makes you better as an interviewer because you have to think about the best way to get an answer from him. I do understand it, and I kind of respect it as well in a weird way. So yeah, it's a very strange relationship I think the press back have with Arteta.
Yeah, even when he was asked about the stupid fucking nonsense Rio Ferdinand came out with the yes. other week, you know, about the, you know, he'd walk into the Manchester United job tomorrow, whatever fucking nonsense it was. You know, he talked about that, but even then he said he did it in this sort of roundabout way where, oh, you know, they have their opinions, but, you know, normally we only highlight the ones that aren't positive rather than talk about all the great things and the great things that they say and the very good points that they make, which was kind of his way of saying, this is absolute fucking bullshit. but he sort of did it in a way where nobody could go back and say, Arteta hits back at Rio Ferdinand nonsense.
Yeah, he knows what he's doing on that front. And yeah. I think maybe that comes from him being a younger manager who's maybe not grown up because he's in his 40s, but as a manager who's grown up in the social media age
mm-hmm.
and knowing how things get taken out of context and how things get rewritten and reshaped. And I think he's very on it and he's very aware of that. And he makes it very difficult, but that's fine.
All right. Let's do a couple of questions because we, these sort of weeks where Arsenal win all the time. It's not that we're short on talking points, but you know, there isn't the drama that comes with some of the other weeks. Here's a question from Ben on our Discord who says, I know we're all enjoying watching Kai Havertz play football right now, but does he deserve a lot more credit than he seems to be getting for his turnaround? Given the fans were on his back from day one, he was seemingly struggling to find confidence. The difference in him now as a man on the field and being part of the system is insane. Mentality monster? Question mark, which sort of ties into something Arteta said today.
Yeah. Whenever you talk to Arteta about Havertz, or you talk to anyone actually at the club about Havertz, players as well, they're always so positive and they really, really like him. And partly I think that's because he seems like a decent guy. And, you know, I think footballers can be a bit detached and he doesn't seem like that. He seems, you know, you talk to employees around the club and he's sort of, he will ask how your day's going. He'll take an interest in you instead of sort of it being a one-way relationship. And that's not commonplace across the footballing world. It might seem, you know, basic to us, but it's just not. So that's a thing that I think has brought him a lot of goodwill. But when you look at what's changed, yeah, I think mentality monster is maybe going a touch overboard, but I think he definitely needs to be praised for his mentality because he throughout all the criticism stuck with it and kept trying things and kept trying to fulfill the manager's demands. And it's difficult because he was asked to do so many different things. He was asked to play so many different roles and started up front against Man City in the Community Shield, then moved into midfield and replicated arguably last season's most popular player in Granit Xhaka, and is a totally different player to Granit Xhaka and was playing a totally different role. And I think as Arsenal fans and observers, it took a while for us to as well to adjust to, now this team is moving slightly further up the pitch and is playing even more dominant football. So if you're going to do that, you need a more offensive-minded midfielder. And, you know, you go from Granit Xhaka to that and it's a difference. And then he moved over to the right-hand side when Odegaard was injured and then he moved back to the left and now he's been playing up front. And to be moved around that often and still produce consistent performances, that's tricky. And I think he's been really good at just keeping plugging away and keeping doing the basics right. And the rest of it has kind of followed. Mm. And he looks so confident now. That Sheffield United goal, he would never have taken that shot on at the start of the season. Now he looks like a really, really confident player who can finish. And he looks like a real attacking asset and a real threat in the final third. And I think that's what we were all hoping that would happen when he came from Chelsea. And you have to bear in mind, Chelsea's been a bit of a dumpster fire for a long time now. And when you come from that environment, and I imagine there's a bit of trauma to get over, and that takes a bit of time. And it's not taken that long, if you think about it. Like, he signed in July, it's now March. It took him maybe a few months, and I think we'd say he probably clicked around December. So it took him maybe a couple months to get used to it, but he's been good. And I it's funny, I don't remember being one who massively got on him when he wasn't playing well. I just thought that he wasn't grabbing games by the scruff of the neck enough. I thought he was too passive in games.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think he's being a to use an Unai Emeryism, a protagonist in games. And that's a massive change for him. And I think Arsenal were a much better side for it.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting today. Is maybe the first time Arteta admitted that things weren't great for him, because all the time when there was this criticism and there was this focus, and we all understand why, so I don't need to go into, you know, the whys and wherefores of all that, but Arteta was always very positive about him. He's doing what I want. He's playing very well, you know, all of this kind of stuff. But, you know, today he said, the attitude he showed all the time when things were not that good in certain phases of the game. And I don't even think he means the game. I just think he probably means the early part of the season where, you know, like you say, he was passive. And I think he was slightly unsure of himself and unsure of either his role or his connection with the teammates. And, you know, that's a thing that can take time. You know, it's pretty obvious to say it, but it's easy to forget it, where it can take time for a player to connect with his new teammates, and it can take time for new teammates to connect with a new player. And I think we're sort of crossed that bridge and, you know, in a positive situation. But, you know, to what extent do you think players are inured from that sort of external noise where, you know, if we spend time online all day, every day, you know, it becomes a much bigger talking point, you know, for us perhaps than for players who might be slightly insulated from that, or who should be insulated from that. Like, I mean, they all have their phones. They can all watch Match of the Day. They can all go on Twitter if they want. I don't know why any footballer in the world would go on Twitter. Just don't really get it. But, you know, they're young men and they do, and they've got their Instagrams and all that kind of stuff. So they're sort of in that social sphere where it becomes very difficult to avoid what people are saying about you. But, you know, within the confines of the training ground and things like that, you know, there's a sort of measure of protection, a sort of a safety blanket, a force field to keep these guys like, okay, you've read all that, so don't fucking pay any attention to it. But it's hard, you know, if you read something bad about yourself, you take it to heart and everything else. But, you know, I do wonder if you know, having come through that and then built those connections within the club and, you know, on the pitch, that no longer is a factor, if you like.
I don't know if we can totally dismiss it as no longer ever being a factor, because
not ever, but I mean, I just mean in that early period, you know, if he was reading stuff or if he was aware of what was being said, if he was aware of 5% of what was being said, his day was ruined every fucking day, basically.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I mean. But
I think he was aware. I think he, I'm trying to think how I should phrase this, but I know for a fact that he was reading stuff, and I know for a fact that he was aware of the coverage, and I know for a fact that he thought it was a little bit harsh, because I don't think a lot of it factored in all the things we were talking about in terms of transition and getting to know a new team and the pressure of a big money signing and moving from club to club and West London, North London, Chelsea, Arsenal, all that stuff is big. And I think he thought maybe some of the criticism of him was a bit over the top, and he was aware of it. So it's impossible to avoid it. But throughout, the noises I heard sort of from that side of things was, as much as he's aware of it and he has opinions on it, he never lost the fact, the sort of the order of priorities, in the sense that the most important opinion, and you hear every footballer say this, but it is a bit true, is that of his manager and that of his teammates and the coaching staff and, mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff. And some bloke on Twitter, I don't think he pays as much mind to it. But at the end of the day, they're human beings. Like, they're like any of us. Like, we can see 100 positive tweets and we'll see the one negative one, and we'll all zoom in on the one negative one. I think you have to be a very certain type of person not to. So that's always going to be a factor, and that's always in the modern age going to be a thing. But I think, yeah, the quietening down of that is a bit chicken and egg, because the quietening down of that has gone hand in hand with an increase in his performances. But also, I think people get bored and they move on from certain sort of focuses of negativity, and they find someone else to focus on, or there's another narrative or there's another headline that they want to think about or talk about. And I think Havertz just had to bide his time until he wasn't the main story. And for a lot of the start of the season, he was. But I think when he started clicking was sort of maybe when people had moved on to talking about other things, and under the radar, he sort of started getting a bit better and started improving. And then maybe some of the positivity came his way. And I think at the same time, also, when there's that negative side, you also get maybe an overcorrection on the positive side. And some people were really, really positive to him and maybe started looking at that a bit more. So,
yeah,
big factor there too.
I just have a funny feeling about Havertz between now and the end of the season. I don't know what it is. I just have a feeling that there's something to come from him that could be really decisive, whether that's a winner at the Etihad or something else. I'm not quite sure. But sometimes a player just gives you that feeling that they're capable of delivering. So I hope that's
right.
The case.
Yeah, right.
So do I. One of the aspects of the game against Brentford is the fact that David Raya can't play because he's ineligible. He's still a Brentford player officially on loan at Arsenal. So that means Aaron Ramsdale is going to come back in. Arteta quite positive about him today, saying he's been brilliant. He's desperate to play. He's fully prepared. You know, I enjoyed the answer to the question, like, would you have liked him to have more game time? He just said, it is what it is. And this is the sort of bare facts of life of professional football, that you are a very good goalkeeper who's not playing because the coach prefers another goalkeeper. Now's your chance. Take it. You know, we're not here to sort of mollycoddle you into the team and make everything okay for you. It's up to you to rise to the challenge that's ahead of you, which, you know, I think Ramsdale will be determined to do. But we had a question on our Discord from Mary Had a Little Ramsdale. some loyalties there, who knows. He says, with Ramsdale coming back into the team against Brentford, it seems a good time to ask, has your view on the dropping of Ramsdale for Raya changed since it first happened? At the time, I was really bemused and angry, as I didn't think it was an upgrade, but now it's become obvious why Mikel wants Raya as his number one. I'm no longer angry. Now I'm just a bit sad about how quickly Ramsdale was dropped and how few chances he's had since then. So, you know, there's always a rush to judgment when something like this happens, and, you know, two or three games in, oh God, it took longer, didn't it? Like, for about 2 months, every week was like, will it be Raya or will it be Ramsdale? Even when, you know, it became very clear very quickly that it was going to be Raya. But how do you view the situation now and you know, the various qualities of the two goalkeepers and, you know, what way it's developed with Raya in the team?
So I guess the situation now is, this is probably Aaron Ramsdale's last game in an Arsenal shirt, as sad as that is to admit, because unless David Raya gets an injury, he's going to play every Champions League and Premier League game between now and the end of the season. And I can't see how Ramsdale stays this summer and how this situation continues. I think Ramsdale's acquitted himself well, as you'd expect him to with the character that he is. I still think that the situation initially was mismanaged. I don't think Arteta had to go as strong as he did on saying, I want to substitute goalkeepers midway through a game. I think in retrospect, that was a silly thing to say. And I think if you asked him, he probably wouldn't say that again, because it created an expectation that there would be rotation that was never going to happen.
Yeah, we just talked about Mikel Arteta adding no fuel to the fire. And that was like wandering around with a fucking petrol can, just pouring it all over the flames.
Exactly,
it was quite unusual for him, actually, I suppose.
Massively
when you look back on it, it was unusual for him to be, I don't know who he was trying to justify it to, whether it was Ramsdale or the fans or himself or whatever it was, but it was, I don't think he stepped that far out of his comfort zone since, it's fair to say.
You know what was really interesting about that one was it was a post-match press conference as opposed to a pre-match one, and he's more emotional in post-match press conferences, as you'd expect, because you know, the game's just been played and we all know how emotional he is on the touchline. So I think maybe there was a part of that. And just thinking back to it, he'd been asked it earlier in the press conference and then someone went back to it. And maybe part of him was thinking like, oh, you know, screw you lot, I'm going to give you an answer, but you know, this is why, and that kind of thing. And it's fine. But I don't think that was the right way to handle it. I still think that Ramsdale should have been given the Champions League group stage games, because back then, it was a case of, with cup games as well, essentially Ramsdale would have been playing midweek, Raya would have been playing weekend. And then you live by what you're saying and you practice what you preach. If you're saying that genuinely, I'm not sure who my number one is, I'm going to try and sort of play them across two competitions and see who's who, see what's what and that kind of stuff. But the reality is that when you see Ramsdale come back into the games, and I think back to that Carabao Cup game against West Ham, where Arsenal didn't have the dominance they have now. They've been to the London Stadium twice this season. One game was totally a transition game, back and forth, back and forth. Arsenal never really had control of it. And yeah, it was Carabao Cup and it was an uneven team and all that stuff. But the second game, they had so much dominance of it because David Raya gives Arsenal that dominance. He's just as important to the dominance as Martin Ødegaard, arguably, because he doesn't go long. He doesn't cede possession super easy. He makes sure Arsenal keep it and he doesn't give the ball back cheaply. And I think that's a huge, huge part of what Arteta's wanted. And everyone talks about that Liverpool game last season where Ramsdale was sublime. And, you know, he kept Arsenal in the title race that day. But people say David Raya hasn't had that kind of game for Arsenal yet. But I think Arteta's argument would be, well, David Raya hasn't needed to have that kind of game for Arsenal yet because the kind of goalkeeper he is, Liverpool would never be able to sort of have that sustained barrage of attacks that they had that day with Aaron Ramsdale in goal, because he doesn't just hoof it long. And we know that Ramsdale isn't sort of your typical sort of old school hoof it long. He was an upgrade on Bernd Leno, who was an upgrade on Petr Cech, who, you know, go back as far as you want. And, you know, the goalkeeper position has evolved arguably more than any position, maybe except for fullback, in the past few years in football. And Arsenal now probably are on par with Liverpool and City when it comes to possession-based goalies, and they don't give away the ball. And that has allowed them to have this dominance that we're praising them for in the past few games. So it is the right decision. And to be honest, I thought it was the right decision when it first came. And I think we all saw that there were maybe certain flaws to Ramsdale's game last season that maybe partially we're willing to overlook because he was such a likeable guy and such a popular member of the squad. And he had those games like Liverpool and Spurs away as well, where he was outstanding and he was man of the match. But David Raya hasn't had, like I said, he hasn't needed to have those man of the match performances because of the way Arsenal play with him in goal. Mm. And I think that's a huge change, and Arsenal looks so much more calm because of it.
Well, yeah, calm is the word I was going to use. I mean, I really like Ramsdale as a player, and I think his character is fantastic. But I wonder if the character is not compatible with the sort of aura that Arsenal are trying to create, in terms of going back to these words like control and dominance. There's a sort of a little bit of chaos factor with Ramsdale. I don't think Arteta particularly likes chaos in any way, in any shape or form, in any aspect of his life, from what we've seen of him on the Amazon documentary to the way he works. You know, if he can eliminate anything that might go wrong, he will eliminate something that might go wrong. And you know, I have to say, at the time, I still feel bad for Ramsdale, because he is a good guy and he connected with the club, he connected with the fans. And like you, I think he'll go in the summer because he's too good to sit around to be a number two goalkeeper at Arsenal or anywhere else for that matter. But I was like, well, this is basically a 7 out of 10 goalkeeper. We swapped it for maybe a 7.25 out of 10 goalkeeper. I think it's a bit more than that now. I do think what Raya gives the team and the sort of calm that he emanates from the back is part of, not exclusively by any means, but part of why, you know, the stats that you mentioned, the XG against, the amount of shots that we're allowing, he's part of that. And it's not to say that we couldn't be close to that or do something similar with Ramsdale, but I just think Raya facilitates it more, rather than you're sort of wondering, is something going to happen or is he going to, you know. Look, all goalkeepers make mistakes. They all do. We saw Alisson do it and Van Dijk do it. So players make mistakes, but I just think there is more assurance to Raya, and that when you've got Gabriel and Saliba and Declan Rice ahead of you is sort of like, it just flows into the rest of the team.
Yeah, so. Totally agree. And that calmness is huge. And yeah, it's a really sad one to talk about, because we all really do like Aaron Ramsdale. But you have to be ruthless if you want to make it to the top. And, and Liverpool had to let go of players who I'm sure they really liked along the way. And Man City had to get rid of Joe Hart, who was their most popular goalie, and they moved on very quickly. So it just happens, and it is a shame.
Yeah. Just a couple of quick things. Mikel Arteta wouldn't talk about Liverpool and Manchester City, but we can. You know, even though it's got nothing to do with us either.
Yeah, nothing to do with me, mate. Sorry.
Nothing to do with me either, Kaya. But I know what I would like to see in this game, and that's, you know, a high scoring draw, a few hamstrings along the way. I mean, is there an argument to be made that a result for, you know, Liverpool might be better for Arsenal? It doesn't feel like that. I can see where people are coming from when they say, well, if Liverpool beat Man City, then maybe it takes the edge off our game against Man City. But it also adds to Liverpool's points tally and momentum, which is considerable and, you know, worrying, I have to say, because, you know, we talk about Arsenal getting results without key players. Liverpool are beginning a lot of good results and a lot of wins, even if they are coming quite late, without key players as well. So momentum is its own thing. So would it be better for us to have both sides' momentum halted just a little bit? Assuming, of course, that, you know, we can put a bit of pressure on them playing before them on Saturday evening. If we can get the 3 points against Brentford, it just gives them something to think about.
I'm actually of the opinion that any points that can be taken away from Manchester City in terms of 3 points being taken away for them, i.e. a Liverpool win, is probably the best result Arsenal can get. And the reason for that, as you mentioned, is Arsenal have to go to the Etihad, where they've scored once in Mikel Arteta's tenure. I think the aggregate score is, I want to say, 11-1 or 12-1, something like that. And it is bad, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And Arsenal have never, ever, even last season, and obviously no Saliba was a big part of that, but they've never looked remotely convincing at the Etihad. And they've been really good at using past sort of traumas to go again and perform really well this season. But the Etihad is a whole different story. And I think Arsenal have got themselves into a position where they need to win a lot of very difficult away games now if they're going to win the title. They've got to go to Old Trafford. They've got to go to Spurs. They've got to go to Brighton. All those games become so much more difficult if you've lost to Manchester City and you've lost handsomely to Man City. So I think anything that can take the pressure off of that is good, because I don't think Arsenal will go to the Etihad and take all 3 points off of them. Listen, I really, really want to be proved wrong on that, mm-hmm. but I don't think it's going to happen. And I think if you can take points away from Man City, if you can take points away from the team who have proved that they can win between February and May every single game in every single competition, that's good.
Mm.
Liverpool, like you say, they're on a really, really good run and they should not be underestimated even in the slightest bit. But at the same time, they've got all those injuries. They've got Europa League versus, you know, Thursday, Sunday, all that stuff to deal with.
Yeah.
They've got an FA Cup run that they're still doing. They've got all the emotion of Klopp's last season and they seem to just be getting by. But we all know from personal experience last year with Arsenal that it's very difficult to sustain that between, you know, March and May. That's very difficult. So I think if you can stop Man City, who for my money are the team who have the depth and the quality to actually really take this title race all the way till the end, then you've got to take it. You've got to take that opportunity. So I personally would think Liverpool winning is a fantastic result. I think we can all agree a Man City win at Anfield would be by far the worst result, though.
Yes.
And a draw is very much okay.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll live with okay. I'm, you know, still to be convinced about City or Liverpool beating City being good for us, even though, you know, I see it, but I just, you know, in my heart, I think I need them both to drop points and for us to hopefully take advantage of that. Look, I've taken up far too much of your time. It's a pleasure talking to you as always, Kaya. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Pleasure as always.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Thank you very much indeed to Kaya. You can find him on Twitter. He is at KayaKynak97, at KayaKynak97. And he writes about Arsenal for football.london. Right, that's just about that for this week's show. Hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much indeed. Obviously, the Brentford game, there's a bit more to say about it, a bit more to talk about. The Ramsdale thing, what changes Mikel Arteta might make. We will preview that game for you over on Patreon. If you'd like to join us, it's patreon.com/arsblog. That's patreon.com/arsblog. We will have that podcast available to you on Friday evening, there or thereabouts, a little bit later than usual, but we will have it. And you can listen to us talk about the Brentford game. We'll probably look ahead a bit to the Liverpool game and some of the other Premier League fixtures as well. So please join us for that. In the meantime, take it easy. Keep fingers crossed for the right result this weekend. We can go back to the top of the table and hopefully, who knows, stay there between now and the end of May. For now, take it easy. Join us on Monday, by the way, for the Arscast Extra. Until then, take it easy, folks. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Hi, Mikel. I just wanted to get the latest information on the team news, please.
The team news is some players will be available. Other players may not be available. Some players who are available will play. Other players who are available may not play. It all depends.
And your thoughts on the opposition for this weekend's game?
They are a football club who play football with footballs. As such, I expect them to come and play football with the footballs that we provide within our stadium.
Of course, there's a lot of focus on their number nine, a player who has been linked with you quite often in the past. Do you view him as a threat?
One moment, please. Calculating. Threat level, severe. My computations show we have a better chance of winning this football game if this threat is eliminated. This press conference is now terminated. You have 10 seconds to leave the room, or you will be terminated. Only joking. You have 5 seconds.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.